I've been enjoying the last couple of days very much. There's been the conference has three parts: analysis, dynamics, descriptive set theory. And so far, the descriptive set theory has been kept to a small minimum, which, from my point of view, is wonderful. It means that I can follow the talks and understand what is happening. There's not going to be much descriptive set theory in my talk either. And I don't have to make too many apologies for that, I think. What I would like to do is make some propaganda for something that we called some years ago generic dynamics. There's a survey that appeared in the proceedings of the Conference on Descriptive Set Theory and Dynamical Systems a couple of years ago, called the Survey of Generic Dynamics, and most of what I'm going to be saying is there. So, Survey of Generic Dynamics in the Descriptive Set Theory 2000. But I will point out a couple of new observations, and in the last part of the talk, I would like to describe one or two problems that are still open and I think are interesting, and maybe some of the bright younger people in this audience will be able to solve if I can persuade them to think about these problems. Okay. So, let me begin by devoting a bit of lip service to the various kinds of dynamics. So dynamical systems, of course, has its origins in classical mechanics. And abstracting various features of the dynamical system, different disciplines that have this word dynamical have evolved. Topological dynamics, founded and studied by Birkhoff's, where you look just at the topology of the space and preserve only the fact that the flow is continuous. What later became called ergodic theory, where there's a measure preserved, or a measure class preserved, and you study properties of that, you can improve the topological structure to a smooth structure, and you get a subject called smooth dynamics. And about 15 or more years ago, Dennis Sullivan started making propaganda for what he called generic dynamics. And this is a framework in which you preserve a bit less than the full topological structure of the space. So let me at once say what I mean by properties of that one studies in generic dynamics. So you have a system, XT. X might be a Polish space, or it might be a compact space, depending on on the setting, and T will be a continuous self-map, continuous invertible. So this corresponds to studying Z actions, where Z is the are the integers. And now, in topological dynamics, you want to study the whole space, all orbits in the space, everything that's going on there. And in generic dynamics, you're happy if you understand what's going on X naught in X, where X naught is a dense G delta. Say T invariant. And so in generic dynamics, you would say, for example, that two systems are the same if you can find an x naught in x and a y naught in y, we have another system, ys. These are dense g deltas, and an equivariant homeomorphism between them. So theta, which commutes with the T and S action. Now, a couple of years ago, Ethan Akin, and I'll get to some specific, some examples of this, but I want to still, in the presenting the framework, I want to remark that Ethan Akin and Ellie Glasner, in a recent paper, have thought about or studied properties like the properties of generic dynamics from a slightly different point of view, which is worth pointing out. They introduce, for compact systems, so these are now compact, they stay in the class of classical topological dynamics, compact systems, and instead of working with these properties, the subsets, which are equivariant, they point out that when that happens, that when you find dense G deltas like this, say for transitive systems, so the systems I'll talk about will be transitive, which means that dense orbits, so there exist dense orbits. For transitive systems, what they say is that the two systems, say X is equivalent to Y, so say X is equivalent to Y, if there exists an extension Z common to X and Y, so the picture is like this, and when I draw arrows like this, what I have in mind, of course, is that there's an action on Z. These arrows denote pi X, pi Y projections, which commute with the action. There are actions here, which I suppress in the notation. I draw my math just between the spaces, and both pi x and pi y are almost 1-1 extensions. Now, almost 1-1 extensions means that generically, again, that means for a dense G delta, generically, pi inverse x of X consists of one point. And the same for Y. On a dense G delta, generically. Because there are dense orbits, you need just one point with a dense orbit that has this property. You just need one point that has this property. Because of the equivariance, if for one point the fiber is a singleton, then along the whole orbit the fiber will be a singleton, and then it's not hard to see that this is a generic property. These almost 1-1 extensions are a standard tool in topological dynamics. I mean, these aren't, I mean, the reason that Ethan and Ellie introduced them here is because these are a well-known, well-studied type of extension that play an important role in the structure theory and topological dynamics. And the connection, the way you can see how to go between these, I'll describe by explaining one further point of view. So the first point of view is that you're studying what happens on density delta sets. The second point of view is that you're studying an equivalence relation where things are equivalent if they have some common extension which is small, which is tight, which is almost 1-1. And the third point of view is that you're really just studying single orbits. So I will, let's say in case two, this means exactly that there exists an X naught in X with a dense orbit and a Y naught in Y with a dense orbit and a continuous map, say theta, that takes T to the N X naught. How do you write this? Equals T to the N theta Y naught. No. Theta T to the N X naught is S to the N Y naught. So theta of X naught equals Y naught. And you just map the orbit to the orbit. So maps like this always exist. And this continuous map on the orbit, actually bicontinuous, we want this to go both ways. So we want the maps on T and X and in Z to T and Y naught. So what this means is that you're really studying topologies on the integers. Topologies on the integers such that when you shift by one, you have a continuous map on the integers. So the action of the transformation from n to n plus one, which is what T does, this action is continuous. So I maybe should say here, topology on the integers. And it should be a Polish topology, I mean a metric topology on the integers. Polish is not to make sense. Metric topology on the integers such that this is continuous and things are equivalent now. Topologies are the same if they're equivalent topologies, if there's a map between them. Okay, so I've spent a few minutes giving sort of some different points of view or languages for how one thinks about this, and now I should begin by giving some content and saying what kinds of theorems, what kinds of results or problems have been discussed in this setting. Okay, so now we come to perhaps the first topic, which is orbit equivalence. I will not say what orbit equivalence is. It's been discussed several times already. And I begin with this and mention a theorem which was what motivated Dennis when he started discussing this with me about almost 20 years ago. So this is a theorem due to Sullivan, myself, and Wright, which says the following. Let G be a countable group. Act something on polar spaces. X and Y. So I have two actions. And now I'm going to use, not give different letters for the action, just let the spaces remind you that there are different actions. So we have two, the same countable group, and we have continuous actions acting on polar spaces, of course, continuously, with dense orbits. So transitive. We don't have the time to discuss the reduction to transitive, to ergodic components in this setting, which is fairly nice and smooth, but countable group acting on polar spaces continuously, just so that things are not trivial and people won't complain, acting, and let's just say continuously and freely, although that's just to save me from saying some more words to rule out the degeneracies, then XG and YG are orbit equivalent. So this is sort of the super, the ultimate generalization of Dye's theorem, if you like. Dye's theorem is a theorem of this type for measure-preserving transformations of Z, ergodic measure-preserving transformations of Z. Dye's theorem, as has been pointed out, was extended to amenable group, but fails, of course, for non-amenable groups, and there's been some discussions here about how badly it fails for non-amenable groups in the category of measure-preserving transformations. But in generic dynamics, all groups are the same. The whole theory collapses. I mean, the theory of orbit equivalence sort of collapses. I promised in the abstract further results. Time is short. There's been recent work of Golodets and some collaborators, students like Sinelchnikov, Kulagin, doing further work on orbit equivalence motivated by the kinds of problems that arise in operator algebras, cocycles, studying outer groups, and so on, of automorphisms of equivalence relation. I won't be able to say very much about this. Now I'd like to go back to properties of the action itself, not simply orbit equivalence, and study somehow, sort of try to do the first chapter in an ergodic theory textbook. The first chapter in an ergodic theory textbook defines ergodic transformations, so ergodic theory. You define ergodic, and then you define weakly mixing. So ergodic has been defined several times, weakly mixing hasn't, so XT, now I have to put in a mu so that we remember we're doing ergodic theory, and there should be a sigma algebra now, but I'll probably usually omit the sigma algebra. XT mu is weakly mixing if X cross X, T tensor T, mu times mu, is ergodic. So take this for a definition. Take that for a definition, and what happens in ergodic theory is that there's a very pretty theorem due to von Neumann, Helmholtz later got into this act. And it gives characterizations of weak mixing. It gives two other characterizations of weak mixing. I'm going to concentrate now on one of them, and that is that if Xt is weakly mixing, then for all ergodic Ys nu, X cross Y, T tensor S, mu times nu is ergodic. So this theorem says as soon as the Cartesian square is ergodic, then the transformation acts as a multiplier. You can think of this as a multiplier property. It, whenever you multiply it by any ergodic transformation, you get something which is ergodic. Now, there's a simple dictionary here. Ergodic, in generic dynamics, ergodic means dense orbit. It's also called topologically transitive or simply transitive, logically transitive. These are different terminologies. Historically, at one point in time, ergodic systems were called transitive systems. So we can define weak mixing here in the same way. X cross X is ergodic. Let's take that to be the definition of weak mixing. Yes? Where? Here, in this category, the definitions are in terms of measure-preserving transformations. There is no loss of generality in assuming that X is compact and T is continuous, because measurable actions can always be compactified. You can always, from the point of view of the ergodic properties, assume that this is compact and that T is continuous. There's no loss in generality in assuming that. But from the point of view of the definitions, the only thing you pay attention to in the definitions and the properties and so on are the measure structure, not the topology. The topology is not needed for any of this. But here, of course, in generic dynamics, I assume a continuous mapping. Otherwise, I can't be discussing generic properties. I can't be discussing dense G deltas. So a very natural question is, okay, is something like this theorem true? So what happens is this. You first prove a proposition which in a sense goes back to Furstenberg, although not in this language, but essentially goes back to Furstenberg, is you prove that if X cross X is ergodic, then so is X cross X cross X for all k. Over here, the nature of the group played no role. When I was giving some of the definitions, I was talking about Z, and then I quickly switched to another group. The audience is rather sophisticated if it was able to absorb the talks we heard yesterday on superrigidity in various forms, so it's, I think, harmless if I go to a different group and not pay much attention to that. Here I should point out that this is for a commutative group. For something like the free group, already this proposition fails. But even for Z, you can't go much beyond the proposition. And what do I mean? There are examples of weakly mixing systems x1 z t x2 t to such that x1 cross x2 is not ergodic. So weakly mixing, not only don't they form a multiplier for the class of ergodic transformations, they don't even form a multiplier for the class of the weakly mixing transformations. This theorem, this phenomenon that underlies this, has been developed further as I pointed out, in a recent paper of Ethan Aiken and Ellie Glasner. There is a nice characterization. All right, I'll say what it is. It'll give me a reason for. Okay. So there is a theorem which characterizes what are the multipliers of the weakly mixing. So a system YS has the property that for all weakly mixing systems XT, X cross Y, T cross S is ergodic if and only if YS is, okay, now this is an unfortunate, I fell into an unfortunate choice of notation. There's a capital S here. There's a little s here that has nothing to do with this capital S. If and only if YS is S ergodic. So as usual, this is a theorem with no content. I have to tell you what S ergodic is. And so far, the only thing you can get a feeling for is that I have some property, some other way of characterizing this multiplier property, which is sort of intrinsic to the system. So what is the definition for S? Okay, so NUV is the set of N in Z such that T to the NU intersect V is not M. So here U and V are open sets in X. T is the system, so there's X, there's U, there's V. Ergodicity means that the set is non-empty for any U and V. And the set of all times when you do intersect, that's denoted by NUV, and S ergodic means that this set is always a syntactic set. So syntactic means bounded gaps. Bounded gaps. This is terminology from Gottschalk Hedlund, which has been become entrenched in topological dynamics. I don't have a good story to tell you as to why that's called syntactic. I mean, Gottschalk explains it at some point, but there's a further dynamical characterization of such systems. I mean, as you can see, this is something that you could imagine checking, especially since it's clear that you only have to check it for a basis, for a countable basis. So you just have to check this kind of property for countable number of sets U and V, whether this type of recurrence, this strong type of recurrence, takes place. I can try to save a few minutes at the end, as I said, for some problems, and one of the problems we'll talk about will deal with times of recurrence, or the nature of recurrence or visits. I mean, it's the same to say here, you could define S recurrent by requiring this for, so maybe I'll just write that down here. S recurrent means that NUU is always syndetic. And S ergodic is basically S recurrence together with ergodicity. And you don't need to really assume this for different U's and V's. As soon as you have some intersection, the recurrence will give you the syndetic feature. Okay, so this is sort of one chapter that you can develop, and as I pointed out, you can develop this further. You then get to trying to understand different systems from this point of view. Now, as Matt pointed out yesterday, I think the simplest class of systems, and one which is well understood, is, say, irrational rotations. Irrational rotations. So let me call them R alpha, since I'm using capital letters for my map. So R alpha is the map of the circle to itself, which takes Z to Z times E to the 2 pi I alpha. So this is rotation by alpha. And you can ask yourself, are these systems the same or different? Are they equivalent in this category that I'm discussing? All groups are orbit equivalent. Funny things happen with weak mixing. These are connected with weak mixing. Does this mean that something funny is going to happen here? So if you try to answer this question, the best point of view is to think of what I described here. For them to be equivalent, what would that mean? It would mean that there would be a point here, a Z naught and a W naught, so that when you looked at Z naught times E to the 2 pi I n alpha, when you looked at this set of points, it would have the same topology on N as W naught beta. Having the same topology means, in particular, that if you look at those points here, which return to Z naught. So if you look at those NK such that This notation is getting out of hand. I'm going to go over to additive notation. So U0 and N alpha. V0 and N beta. Getting tired of the circle. So you can look at those sequences such that this converges to U0. And if they have the same topology, that would mean that they would have to be the same sequences such that Nj beta converges to the V0 plus Nj beta converges to V0. But the points V0 and U0 are irrelevant. This is convergence to zero. Mod 1, of course, of these sequences. And if alpha and beta are different, then you can converge to zero along one without going to zero along the other. This is clear if they're irrationally related, but even if one of them is twice the other, I mean, even if beta is twice alpha, even if beta is twice alpha, you can have Nj alpha converging to a half, and then twice Nj alpha will converge to zero or one, which is the same, so that you won't have the same topology. As soon as the irrational, as soon as the numbers alpha and beta are different, the topologies are different. So what this means is that these are different transformations. These are inequivalent. Well, that's encouraging. The story begins to look encouraging, but on the other hand, dull in some sense. I mean, if things are going to turn out to be just like they are in topological dynamics or in ergodic theory, then it's not going to be much fun in looking at generic dynamics. So after looking at irrational rotations, the next thing to think about, at least if you've been trained or have grown up the way I grew up in this area, yeah, I guess training is the wrong word. I wasn't really trained in this area. The next thing you would look at is the two-shift. With the shift transformation, say, call it sigma 2. Again, this has been described already in the three shift, a classic. But now viewed just topologically. There's a 2 here. Okay, so let me call this perhaps omega 2, and call this omega 3. So I have two transformations, omega 2, sigma 2, and I have omega 3, sigma 3. And topologically, they're of course not the same. They're not the same topologically because, for example, this has two fixed points and that has three fixed points. So topologically, they're not the same. That's trivial. If you put the sort of maximal measure, the most random measure, a half here and a third here, then measure theoretically, they're not the same because of entropy. This was Kolmogorov's discovery, that there's an invariant which distinguishes them. What about generically? Are they the same or not? Okay, these are the shift. Greg, you, I think, would describe, put this on the board on Monday. Oh, no, okay. I'll be happy to. Sigma 2, omega. I'm just apologizing why I didn't define it. Omega is a point here. Sigma 2, omega, the nth coordinate of that is equal to omega n plus 1. And that's either the left shift or the right shift, depending upon whether you're shifting the arrow or shifting the sequence. I mean, I never know. People say left shift and right shift, and I never know what they mean, because I always think of the shift either as the way I do it when I'm doodling on a piece of paper. You can't shift the whole sequence. So what you do is you just shift the arrow. And then you don't have to recopy the sequence. I mean, this is... So from my point of view, it's the arrow that moves, and others think of the sequence as moving. It's like concave, convex. I'm not, never sure whether a function is... I know what it means for a set to be convex, but whether a function is convex or concave always confuses me, because I'm never sure it should be looking up or down. So. Okay, so the question again is, are these equivalent? In generic dynamics. And this was answered sort of around the same time that Dennis and I were doing these things on orbit equivalences. This question was raised, and the first to give a proof was, the first to answer it was Mike Keane. He didn't publish his proof, and in the survey that I described at the beginning, I provided a proof for this theorem, which is that the two-shift and the three-shift are equivalent. Why equivalent? I should maybe just say isomorphic. In generic dynamics. This goes a bit further than simply the two shift and the three shift, of course. All shifts, you can push the argument probably, although I haven't written down the details, to things like systems with specification. These are certainly, say, shifts of finite type would work. But I don't think I should start elaborating on various extensions of this. I was planning to give a quick outline of how you prove this, but I wanted to leave some time for problems. So perhaps I'll come back to this and give you some idea of how to prove this. It's not, maybe I'll just tell you what the strategy is. So stop with the strategy. Strategy is find points, omega 2 in omega 2, omega 3 in omega 3, with dense orbits, and LK going to infinity. So here's omega 2 and here's omega 3. The LKs go to infinity, and when you look at the window of size minus LK to LK, what you see in omega 2, let me call that A sub K. And the word that you see, so AK is this whole word, the word that you see here, let me call BK. So LK go to infinity quickly, you have AK and BK, and okay, so far I haven't said anything. And now the point is that wherever AK occurs in omega 2, so if over here you happen to see AK, then underneath it, in exactly the same position, you should see BK, and vice versa. So for all K, the quantification is like this. For all K, this should happen. So this is the strategy. If you do this, it's not hard to see that the topology on omega 2 is the same as the topology on omega 3. So these are can be matched. And this matching can be extended to... I didn't explain the connection between getting a mapping on one point and everywhere that comes from a classical theorem of Lavrentiev, which says that you can extend homeomorphisms to G deltas, which contain the set. Are the same, yes, yes, yeah. That's what I mean. 1, 2, and 3, I mean, all three of those descriptions were sort of different ways of looking at the... Okay, and then to actually do this, okay, this is, I'm sure people in the audience can work that out. Okay, I've given some indications. So this is in that survey I was describing. More can be said. I mean, it seems from this that entropy may not matter at all. However, on the other hand, as emerged in some discussions with Ellie Glasner, recently, a couple of years ago, I mean, I've been talking about these things with him for many years, we observed that the following is true, namely, the two-shift is not isomorphic to any system. And now I mean compact. I mean, I'm sort of in Ellie's framework where I'm talking about compact systems, but equivalence in his setting of finding a common 1-1 extension is not isomorphic generically. Let me just put that in. I can't read it, so certainly you can't. Isomorphic generically. Is not isomorphic generically to any system, to any compact system with zero entropy. So the precise numerical, the precise value isn't preserved in this category, but you can still distinguish between zero entropy and the two-shift. Now, I should warn you that this category is funny because if you take an almost 1-1 extension of the two-shift, then that's a bigger system, and it's the same from this point of view, but almost 1-1 extensions can have factors which have zero entropy. But Okay, there's more to be said than just this statement, but that goes into a sort of different direction. And now I save myself a little time so that I can play the role of Cato. So you remember Cato, the Roman senator, Carthaginem delenda est, at the end of each session he would repeat the refrain, Carthage must be destroyed. So I'm going to try once again to find somebody to solve a problem that I haven't been able to solve for many years. And the problem is not, won't have any dynamics in it. Its connection with this material is that the problem arose when Dennis and I were trying to apply this orbit equivalence theorem that I described earlier. We were trying to apply that to solve a classical problem, which later was solved by Matt Forman and Darty. So I don't have the time to explain the background, and I'm just going to launch in and describe to you the problem. It fits in this area because it's a problem about the bare category. So, problem. So, if you've gotten tired of generic dynamics, you can sort of forget about dynamics and just think about the bare space. For example, just think about the Cantor set. Okay. So we all learn about Banach limits. Learn about Banach limits in undergraduate, whatever. So bounded sequences, you can define a limit so that for all an in little l infinity, this limit exists. And it has nice properties. It has the properties you expect of limits. It's additive. Additive, it's shift invariant. It's in between the lim sup, the lim inf, the usual properties of the Banach limit. Okay, so this is undergraduate. This is when you do the fundamentals of calculus. They first teach you that not all sequences converge, but then you get a little more advanced. Ah, yes, there is a way to get all sequences to converge. Just have to change the idea of what you mean by convergence. So you go to a more advanced class, and instead of looking just at sequences, you're looking at functions. So now un of x is a uniformly bounded sequence of functions. So you can take your favorite Banach limit and apply it. On this space, x is, my x is now this space, the unit interval, it's all the same. I'm explaining slowly. You can take uniformly bounded sequence of functions, apply this limiting operation to it, and you get a limiting function. Now, you would like, of course, some reasonable properties to be preserved. Now, it's hopeless to try to preserve something like continuity, but you might try to preserve something like measurable. So how about measurable? Now, for analysts, most of the time, Lebesgue measurable is perfectly adequate. So for Lebesgue measurable functions, while not every Banach limit will have the property that this remains Lebesgue measurable, such special Banach limits were constructed by Mokobotsky, and then later, I guess, others. So Mokobotsky, I think he was the first, as far as I know, first constructed limbs such that for all the vague measurable un, limb un is the vague measurable. Okay, so that's fine for ergodic theory, where you're working with a Lebesgue measurable or some other measure, it's the same. How about bare measurable? So bare measurable that means replacing the Lebesgue measurable sets by Borel Madmiger. Okay, so Borel Madmiger. So here, Chirpinsky showed that no such limb exists. The last time I looked for the reference to Chirpinsky, I had trouble finding it. I mean, my memory tells me it's a Chirpinsky theorem. In that survey, I think I give a proof of it, but I would be happy if somebody could really provide me with a reference for where Chirpinsky actually did this. I think that I once knew, but it's gone. Okay, so what is the problem? The problem is that we would like something which comes close to what Chirpinsky showed can't exist. And what does come close mean? Let gamma be the group, the direct sum of 0, 1. So these are finite number of coordinates are different from 0. Adding mod 2, gamma acts coordinate-wise. So there is a dynamics anyway, but coordinate-wise, addition on 0, n. Because this countable group just acts by coordinate-wise. Is that clear? I mean, this is that X that I wrote there is a compact group, coordinate-wise, and this is a countable dense subgroup, gamma acts. And the problem is there a projection from bounded bare measurable functions un to bare measurable functions now such a projection which is not coming from a pointwise limit that you can show exists because the bounded bare measurable functions form a very nice lattice so it's not hard to show that there's a nice projection which has all of the nice properties of being between the agreeing with the limit when it exists. But since it's not coming from a pointwise limit, we don't know that this projection is equivariant with respect to this gamma action. And this is what I would like to know. Is there a projection from bounded to bare measurable functions equivariant with respect to gamma. So let me just write what that means and then I'll stop. sorry, running a minute or two over time. So what that means is that if you take the limit of a sequence of shifted functions, so this is a different sequence of functions. I shift the functions by gamma, but this should be the limit of un x, of un evaluated at gamma x. This is the equivariance. Now, of course, pointwise limits trivially have this property, and gamma is a union of finite groups. For any finite group, it's trivial to get such a property because you could apply this global projection on just a small piece of the space and then move it around with the group. The problem is such an equivariance bringing you into the Sierpinski situation, or does such a thing, such an object exist? That's the problem, and I think I'll stop here. Thank you.